for me, fashion is a verb. So it's to fashion.
My name's Claire Press, and I'm Vogue Australia's sustainability editor. You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis.
I just think it's curiosity at the core of it. Like, I just really want to know the answer to things.
You talk about revolution in 68. No, we make the revolution before.
Can we just go back to making really beautiful clothes with a soul and minimize the waste and think a little before we make things and bring back the value?
Provided you wake up every morning and you're aware of the fact that your wardrobe is in the fashion supply chain, then you're a fashion decision maker.
Join me every week as we talk ethics, sustainability, and the business and madness of fashion. From who made your clothes to how they impact on the environment to the politics of personal style.
My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell them, yeah, because everything is just fine.
Hello, everyone. How are you this week? I'm actually in a bit of a hurry because tomorrow I'm going up to the Barrier Reef to check on the health of the coral up there. We're going to make an amazing show about that. But it's not just because I want to be quick with the intro this week that I'm going to keep it short. It's because our guest is the Canadian architect Jason McLennan. He's the founder of the Living Building Challenge. And he says this thing at the end of our interview. It's like advice on how we can make change and dare to release our ideas into the world. And when I played it back, I thought, actually, this should be the intro. I should let him do the intro. So that's what I'm going to do. We will share some links so you can read all about Jason's extraordinary work and that of the Living Future Institute that he founded and the revolutionary ideas that we discuss about how we can not just green our built environment, but totally rethink it so that it's regenerative, so it provides havens for animals and biodiversity. It's all about like really living in harmony with nature. Or as Jason puts it, creating places that are not only lovely, but express the love we have for people, for animals, and for the environment too. It's not the sort of idea you normally hear from an architect or a fashion designer or anyone in business, is it? Well,
I have a whole philosophy that I'll share with you if you want.
Oh, yeah.
I've written about it in a book called Suk and Rua, and I call it my three-quarter baked philosophy. So the world is filled with half-baked ideas. We don't need any more of those. But too many people in the world try to wait till their ideas are fully baked before they get it out, and they therefore produce nothing. And so what I believe in wholeheartedly is in an obligation we have to put our ideas out in the world three-quarter baked. And by three-quarter baked, it's kind of like, you know, when you take the cookies out of the oven and they're still gooey and they're really good like that. There's magic there, because what you're basically saying when you take it out of the oven is you're letting the universe finish baking it. And so your gift is to get an idea out three-quarter baked and not be selfish or perfectionist to the point where you think that you have the ability to perfect something because you don't. But you have a gift to give by putting an idea out and let others criticize it, let others shape it. And then magic happens. And that willingness to put things out in the universe is at the core of my whole belief system. Put it out and then detach from it. That's the key, though. People are so afraid of failure. They're so afraid of people saying that they're wrong, that nothing happens. And the key is to be okay with being wrong, to be okay with failing, and to let others help perfect your idea, because they're not your ideas. They're ideas that came through you, and we are there to be sort of a vessel, if you will, to get them out.
Didn't you just love that? If you're inspired by what you hear, please do share on social media. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Mrs. Press. I'd love it if you share it on Facebook too. You can find me there at Wardrobe Crisis. And a quick thank you to our new Patreon supporters. You've made my day. Now, let's start from the top. Jason McLennan, welcome to the Wardrobe Crisis podcast. And thank you for agreeing to do this very last minute on your visit to Sydney.
My pleasure.
You've been walking all around the city. What have you seen?
I've been walking everywhere. I have seen everything in the city, the entire city, every block, every building I visited.
But I ask you that, obviously you haven't, but I ask you that because I think in your game, it must be quite fascinating to look up and look around in cities.
Yeah, I like to figure out how a city ticks and what makes it unique. Every city has its own signature.
We're going to get into a bit more about what might make the future of cities tick. But Jason, I met you on Friday at something called the Living Future Symposium.
Yes.
What is it? What's it all about? Share that with us.
I created an organization in the United States many years ago now called the Living Future Institute, and its tagline is creating a world that is socially just, culturally rich, and ecologically restorative. And the idea is that we need to transform pretty much everything in civilization to move towards...
Just a small idea.
Just
then.
A small idea.
I was like, that sounds eminently reasonable.
Yes,
and then you're like,
yes.
The idea is transform
Well, why work
everything?
On a small idea? I don't understand that. Let's put everything into a small idea. No, it's really, the idea that we need to rethink everything.
Okay, I want to just begin, before we unpack that, by zipping through some terms that I think some listeners, they might be new for. They were new for me. In a recent interview with you, Jason, it was from 2018. It's for a journal called Design Intelligence Quarterly. Mm. You were asked what regenerative design looked like when you started out, and you pretty much said it wasn't in existence.
That's right.
But what is regenerative design?
Well, it's an idea whose time has come. Regenerative design is really this notion that we need to move towards solutions that are not merely less bad, but actually good. We need to move towards solutions that are not minimizing our footprint, which is something probably people have heard, and actually moving towards healing and restoring and regenerating the world. So it's actually more of a concept of bringing life back to the planet.
Mm.
And that is clearly where we need to head. It's not enough to just recycle or reduce what your harm is in the world. We actually have to be agents of regeneration, of positive change.
It's funny that it has taken so long for such a thing to catch on, because it's a sticking plaster, isn't it, to say let's make it a little bit less terrible. I mean, that's not a very great thing to aim for. I interviewed William McDonough on this podcast. We'll share a link. But he talks about that
he
whole
does.
Idea.
Yeah, we're...
You must like him.
We've known each other for years, he and I, and I think we tend to think similar about the state of the world and what needs to happen, and we're both architects.
In that interview that I mentioned, you said that in the late 90s and the early 2000s, the ideas of green architecture or eco or just sustainable architecture were kind of put in place by two organizations. One was LEED, and one was, just from a US perspective, the Green Building Council. What's LEED?
LEED, over here you have Green Star, which is a rating system used to evaluate buildings and their impact on the environment. And LEED is basically very similar to Green Star. It came along before Green Star, actually. It stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. Was created and launched by the U.S. Green Building Council. And it's kind of in the U.S. and Canada and a few other countries, it's kind of the de facto sort of benchmark for basic green performance, if you will.
Is it less bad stuff? Or is
it is. Yeah, it is. It's really about moving the market from where it is to a slightly better place, which is the right direction. We just don't have the luxury of going slow anymore.
Okay, the best place would surely be biophilic design, and that's a phrase I only just learned
a few
weeks ago. And I thought, when I caught on to this, I was like, obviously everyone knows what this is because it's such a brilliant idea. But literally shared it on Instagram today and everyone was like, what's that? I'm Googling it. So what is it?
Well, it's this idea that we have this innate need to be around other life forms, and that it's the... love of life, basically. And E.O. Wilson is a famous scientist and writer.
Yeah.
And he basically popularized the term. And he's a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning scientist. Pretty interesting guy. You should get him on your show.
I should. Do you know what? I was just thinking, sorry to be such a name dropper of people who've been on the show before, but it's good to go back and listen to these episodes. We interviewed the extraordinary Vincent Stanley, who's director of philosophy at Patagonia. Mm. And he was the one who told me about E.O. Wilson.
Yeah.
I love how... by sucking your brain marvelousness out on this podcast, we can all learn more.
There's all sorts of great people doing great things.
But what does biophilic design look like? What does it mean? Because it's more than just putting plants in a room.
Yeah, I think it's actually a new biophilic design is a new discipline that looks at answering the question, how do you bring life into cities? How do you bring life into buildings in meaningful ways? And how do you ensure that people are exposed to the natural world in a way that provides for their health and well-being? It's in many ways about health.
But it could be about creating spaces where you're bringing the outdoors in, for example.
Absolutely.
Or accessing green spaces easily from a building. Or what does it look like practically?
It can look like all sorts of things. I think that takes many different forms depending on where you are in, you know, in a city, where you are in a building. But in essence, it's bringing, whether it's plants, water, sunlight, even, you know, the pet dog in some instances. It's about bringing life into our lives.
You talked about this yesterday. You talked about habitat and this idea that when, as architects try to create wonderful spaces, they should be thinking of habitat not just for the humans occupy these spaces, but for all diversity in nature.
That's correct.
Or some of it anyway, beyond the dog. But I mean, thinking about how these spaces, yeah. If we talk about that word regenerative, it's also about how you can make these spaces habitable by nature and creatures other than ourselves, right?
Yeah, we've done a good job of excluding nature from our lives. And yeah, with the exception of a few species like dogs, and cats and pigeons that, you know, and rats that have found their way in, we don't do a good job of allowing for the habitat of other organisms in our communities. And we've crowded them out and sterilized our environments, which is why we have to have biophilic design, because we're sort of making amends for decades now of excluding life from our cities.
Yesterday at the symposium that I just mentioned, you talked about the Living Building Challenge and about the work that the Living Future Institute does.
Yes.
You also mentioned this guy, Buckminster Fuller, who literally is another one of these people I'd never heard of until a couple of weeks ago when someone on this podcast mentioned him. That was in response to a question about activism. It was in the Extinction Rebellion episode. I'd never heard of him. He talked about, this interviewee talks about Buckminster Fuller and Spaceship Earth. And I thought he must be some sci-fi philosopher.
He kind of was.
An architect, right?
Well, he was, he was kind of a lot of things. Maybe the more recent Leonardo da Vinci of our century in some ways. He invented the geodesic dome, which people know, and he invented a lot of words, like synergy, I think was one of his words.
Really?
I think so. Check that one. But he was really ahead of his time, several decades ahead in terms of really understanding humanity's place on the planet and sort of imagining a future where we needed to create conditions that were healthy for all people through all time. He's a real, real genius.
American, based where?
American, practiced all over the place as ideas have traveled all over the world.
You shared a quote there that you particularly love, and it was?
Yeah, if you want to change something, you have to make the thing you want to change obsolete, basically. And I interpret that to be that if you want to change something, you have to throw a better party. You have to, you know, invent a better mousetrap and find a way not to use guilt and shame to motivate people, but to show them a better way.
You talked about those better ways being love as well as regeneration.
Well, I talk about love quite a bit because in many ways it's what fuels everything that I do and I believe in, and the designs that we do is about creating places that are not only lovely, but express the love we have for people, for animals, for the environment.
You also talked, when you gave your keynote at yesterday's event, about how people thought you were basically crackers when you started talking about this stuff.
People still do.
And it dawns on me that even though it's a beautiful idea and one that I find very persuasive, to think about love at the core of an architect's practice, it is a bonkers idea, and people must have thought you were completely off-piste, ahead of your time, or bananas.
Yeah, I think probably some people did. When I created the Living Building Challenge, it was illegal in every market that I practiced in. It was incredibly expensive. It was impossible to find the materials that I was basically saying you had to build with. It was not a utopian standard, but pretty close in people's minds. But
so what exactly is it?
The Living Building Challenge, what I like to say, it's the most stringent green building protocol or philosophy in the world. And it really is the way that you measure whether you've succeeded at building buildings that are good for all of life. And we also have a Living Product Challenge, which could apply to fashion. And we have other protocols that are useful as framing tools.
You use the analogy of a flower and say that if we acted more like the flower, then we could create more beauty and more integrity in our work.
Yeah, I early on picked as sort of the mascot, if you will, for the program, a flower. You know, a flower or plant has to get all of its energy from the sun. It can't use fossil fuels. It has to be, you know, water independent. It has to get all of its water from the rain that it can capture in its root system. It can't build a pipeline from somewhere else. It's habitat for other species. It's beautiful.
But you didn't just look at the flower and think you don't need fossil foods. You actually used the symbolism of the petal and looked at how you might use that format to look at. Is it six of them, the six
petals? There's seven petals. And I kind of geeked out on the flower thing a little bit. The program has categories, which I call petals. And all the sort of metaphors that we use in our work are biological rather than mechanical. Mm. And if you think about it, most of the time we use mechanical. We talk about the body as a clock, or we talk about machines for living in. And that's kind of gotten us off on the wrong path. And so we try to use language to reconnect people to what's important as well, again, which is life. So we use biological metaphors and framing wherever we can.
So some of those petals are water, place,
beauty, equity, materials, health and happiness.
Equity.
Yes.
I mean, I love that you include that in this framework.
Well, we can't solve the problems that we have to solve, whether it's climate change or habitat loss, pollution writ large, unless we're also dealing with inequities around the world and social injustices around the world, that these issues have to be solved simultaneously and together.
You mentioned other mechanisms that you've brought into play or designed as part of the work that your institute does and the challenge sets.
Yes, just. I worked to develop a protocol to help businesses transparently share how they're treating their people, basically.
So looking at things like diversity and fairness and equity in the workplace.
You got it. Yeah, a whole host of issues. How are they doing? Because every day you and I, we go out and we buy clothing, we buy food, we spend money at, you know, in different places, and we're voting with our dollars, basically. And it would be good to know whether we're doing so in accordance with our values, and are we supporting businesses that are good for, you know, treating their people well? Are they supporting gender equity? Are they supporting animal rights? Are they, you know, what are they doing, and do they deserve your money? So the JUST label it's like a nutrition label for social equity.
But and that you're applying to this whole building and construction industry.
We are,
anyone
yeah.
dealing with the built environment.
But people are welcome to use the JUST system in any business. You could use it in fashion. You
but
can use
there's another one that is even more relevant, I think, to the current conversation in fashion around supply chains, and that's Declare.
Declare actually came before JUST, and it was basically because it's the nutrition label for ingredients within building products, basically.
I just love the language because we're so familiar with it when we look at a food product.
Yeah, well, that's where the idea came from. You know, if you go down the grocery aisle to buy food, and let's say that your child is allergic to peanuts, you need to know if there's peanuts in the package. But then when you go to a store to buy a pillow for your child's room, you probably need to know if it's going to give your kid cancer
or
give them, whatever, you know, you need to know. But you can't, because all those things are invisible. And we're surrounded by furniture and interior products and clothing and everything, where we don't really know the chemical constituents within them and their impacts. They could be, you know, bad allergens. They could be carcinogenic, and we're sleeping with them, you know.
Oh, God. So, and we know that we are. I mean, matches drenched in flame retardant
That's
chemicals.
Correct.
Right now we're sitting on some, could be leather, could be faux leather, not sure, swanky chairs in a meeting room.
Yep.
We have no idea what chemicals we use to produce these chairs.
Right. So I just got fed up with that and said, well, why hasn't someone created a nutrition label for building materials? And I looked around and said, well, fuck, I'm going to do it.
When did you do this?
when did I launch it? It's like 2009, I think.
And how did it go down?
Well, it was sort of like my other ideas, where people said, you know, manufacturers are never going to tell you what's in their ingredients. And I said, no, the right ones will. And then we'll drive business to them. And
you also noted that many of them didn't know. And that there are so many parallels with that in the fashion industry.
That's right.
Or don't want to.
There's lots of people with good intentions, but they hadn't focused on it. And that's the great thing about transparency, is that it shines a light on issues and then people wake up. And you can't sort of unsee things, you know.
There is another protocol or tool that is in your toolbox, and that is the chemical one, which is called...
The Red List.
Now, yeah. I'd never heard of that, but you made it up, right?
I did.
You're now working with Google on it. I mean, other companies have adopted this.
Tons of companies are using my Red List, and it's we use it in Declare to, you know, highlight. Basically, the idea is that there are chemicals that really have no safe exposure limit at certain points in their supply chain. So even if it's like safe during its use, it's not safe in the factory, for example, or if it's it's not safe at the end of life when it goes in the landfill and gets in the water. So there are chemicals that we basically said, you know what, we need to just get them out of the supply stream. So there's just the worst offensive stuff. So then I reached out to different toxicologists and experts to say, let's make a red list and put it out there. And that was really hard, but it's caused really great positive ripples in the building supply chain industry, where people are reformulating their products because of the red list. And Google and other big companies have adopted the red list as a procurement sort of lens to say, yeah, we don't want any of this stuff in our buildings. And because of that, manufacturers have responded.
Okay, you're saying let's build buildings that are regenerative and that don't use obvious nasties in their construction or in their interiors. Fine, but it's more than that. It's much, much more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't want them to use fossil fuels. So all the energy has to be with renewable energy. So most of the buildings have solar panels on their roof and they're not using fossil fuels for anything, for heating, for light, for anything.
Let's talk about the Bullet Center because it's a brilliant example of this working in real life. An office building, 6 stories.
Yeah, it's a fantastic building and it was a real pleasure to be involved in that project. And the Bullet Center is in Seattle, Washington. We believe it's the most energy efficient office building in the world. And it generates more energy than it uses on an annual basis with solar in the least sunny city in the United States.
I mean, all the solar panels are on the roof, which is quite a small, relatively speaking, footprint. And what you've done is you talk about, I've watched a speech that you gave about this online, we'll share a link, and you talked about working backwards and saying, okay, we need to understand what our budget is for before we design it. And that's not how we normally do stuff. We normally design whatever we want and then see what the impacts are later.
That's right. Well, and I'm glad that you mentioned that because it's kind of inherent in the philosophy of the Living Building Challenge is the idea that we have to respect limits. And as a species, we have forgotten the notion of limits. We use our technologies to break through limits at great peril, whereas every other species kind of has to stick to what food is available, what energy is available, what water is available. We cheat, but it's catching up to us. And so the living building...
you can't get away with it.
Yeah, you can't, not for long anyway. And, you know, the Living Building Challenge says, start with what you can harness, basically, whether it's energy or water, etc., and build within those limits. That's all you get.
So in this case, you're saying, well, actually, we've only got this amount of space on the roof. Therefore, we need to, and in the end, it was 80% more efficient.
We had to just make the building.
Buildings.
Yeah, if we wanted to build the 6-story building, we had to make it super efficient. We had to rethink everything, and that's what the team did.
You said in that speech, it depends where you are, because if you're in the desert, you've got to think like a cactus.
That's right. And that's, again, part of the philosophy is that we build our cities the same everywhere in the world. And we build our buildings the same regardless of the...
Without thinking about what the environment around them
is. Right, that's because we're cheating, right? We're using energy as a crutch. And it's caused all the problems we have with climate change and everything else.
Mm, but back on the Bullet Center, you've got not only this remarkable energy efficiency in the space in terms of the solar panels and... what, dealing with the lights, I guess? I mean, what's that for? Because it's not for heating, because you've built a building that can pretty much deal with its surroundings in order to heat and cool itself, right?
Yeah, the building is very much alive in many ways. There's sensors throughout the building.
I like that you say alive.
Yeah, it's interesting because aesthetically, it looks pretty mechanistic aesthetically, but it actually behaves very differently. It's always responding to something, the temperature, humidity, light levels, and doing something about it. And so windows open and close automatically, lights go up and down, the heating in the floor, you know, comes on, et cetera. And these, you know, blinds, external blinds deploy to block out when it's too much sun, et cetera. And the idea is to create, kind of like our bodies are always trying to create a condition inside that is ideal for our survival. And that's what the Bullet Center is trying to do to itself as well. And it uses a tiny amount of energy because of that.
But when people queued around the block to see this office building, and you remark that it's not a museum, it's not a very exciting building if you think about its functionality.
That's correct.
It's
just an office building. There's nothing special about what happens inside.
But they queued because they wanted to see the composting toilets, which are on 6 floors and require no water and sewerage output connection to the mains.
That's correct. Yeah, the biggest thing people want to see when they come to the Bullet Center are the toilets. which is funny. I think, yeah, in the end, we're obsessed with potty jokes and such things.
But it's amazing how you've managed to do that. So you're well, not connected to the main sewage.
The technology has been around for a while, composting toilets, but they used to be pretty clunky. They're getting better. I'm still waiting for the iPoo to be invented. That's my challenge to the industry. I want the sexiest composting toilet in the world designed, something that like Apple would design so that everyone is demanding a composting toilet.
Bill Gates is demanding a composting toilet. I just watched a documentary about him. He's really obsessed with his next great challenge is try to figure
poop.
Out.
Yeah, for developing countries in particular. Yeah, but I think it needs to be for everyone. We need to move away from this sort of Victorian notion of shitting in our water supply and then trying to use tons of energy to get it back out.
Actually doesn't make any sense, does it? I feel like everything has been pointing me towards toilets recently. I just keep watching all this stuff, like documentaries and I don't know. And it feels like this is the great undiscussed.
It is.
Because it's disgusting. See what I did there? But we actually do. You wanted shit jokes. I got some.
Yeah, it's good.
I've just been with my father-in-law all day. I've got them at my fingertips. But this is fundamental stuff. It's how we live and how the way we live impacts on our environment. And, I mean, looking at that Bill Gates doco, if you are not privileged enough to have this stuff whisked away, then its impacts are writ large on the health of your kids, whether or not you can go outside your house without vomiting. You know, this stuff is, we don't have to think about it when it's taken away from us, is what I'm saying.
That was the whole point, out of sight, out of mind. And this idea that there is no away, but we designed our cities like, yeah, our waste is away. And usually the away was to some community that was poorer than ours and browner than ours, to be real about it, and the environment. So we send, whether it's our trash, our waste, or, everything else, we push it away.
It's back to what we were talking about before with regards to just, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is exactly why social justice fits into this equation.
Do you think if you were to be interviewed again by that journal I mentioned at the start when they said, what was it like when you started and how's it changed and what did regenerative design look like then versus now, what do you think about the future? Are we at a stage where conventional architects are going to start looking at this stuff?
Well, I think conventional architects are starting to think about it, but they don't yet know how to do it. Some are learning. The clients are not there yet in terms of real numbers, which is why our buildings are still the way they are for the most part. But what has changed is we've been building these examples like the Bullitt Center that you mentioned and others, and each one we build is sort of proof concept that this is possible now. We don't need new technologies. We have all the technology that we need. And we have the know-how. There's enough of us now that know how to do this.
The solutions are there.
The solutions are there and the know-how's there. But what hasn't been there is the will.
You talked before about make the party so brilliant everyone wants to come to it.
That's the idea. That's why we're building these things. They're like little parties.
Let's talk about some in the region in which we find ourselves right now. So there is an amazing building, which is the Tūhou Tribal Parliament in New Zealand.
There is. That's a fantastic project.
Completed in 2017?
Yes, I think that's right.
The architect was 82, I think, when he started working on this, and he's since passed away. His name was Ivan Mersep.
Yeah.
But tell us about that building, because it's a community building.
Yeah, well, and I got to meet Ivan and participate in a couple early charrettes with Jazzmax as the architects, and Ivan was their senior designer on the project, really wonderful guy, and he didn't get to see it built.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it wasn't finished completely.
But there's something quite lovely about this being a parliament building, a community building about culture.
Yeah, so the Tūhou is a tribe on the North Island. And they had an opportunity to build this facility, and they heard of the Living Building Challenge or was introduced to them, and they felt like it was a perfect alignment with their values and their philosophy in terms of their sort of living in the land and their connection to place. And so when they heard about it, they're like, well, yeah, that's what we need to do. We have to build a living building. And for them, it was then a real journey of discovering, well, how should they do that? And what should they build it out of? And what should it look like and feel like? And they did it. And it's a fantastic building and was featured in a feature-length documentary called Ever the Land.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so people want to share a link. It's a great film. And it captures sort of the whole story of that project.
What I loved about that building is that it's really colourful and it looks very distinctive. And it reminded me of something I heard you say, which was, it's not about a universal aesthetic. This is about ideas and systems. It's not about just overlaying something that looks the same in every case.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, in that way, it's kind of freeing to the design community to figure out their expression, which is the way it should be. Mm. It's a, you know, it, I would assume it's the same for fashion. You don't want everyone looking the same the whole time.
Absolutely not. But then there's something in, and not to be slagging off Buckminster Fuller, but there's something in the geodesic dome, which is like, if you like that, good, you're ready to go. If you don't, it doesn't work for you.
That's right.
But your ideas,
yeah, I'm not a big fan of the aesthetic of geodesic domes myself.
But if you're not, you can't do it. That's this is not about that.
Yeah, no, this is about a philosophy, and it's about an approach and an impact, a positive impact in the world. It's not about style or form.
Or functionality, because in terms of what the building's use is.
It's about how you do what you do.
There's one that you shared a picture of. I'd love to go see it. And it's funny that I'd like to go and investigate some more shit in this discussion.
There you
but
go.
There's a sewerage plant.
Oh, yeah. My old firm designed this wonderful. It's in Rhinebeck, New York, which is upstate New York, not in the city of New York, outside. And it's a sewage treatment plant.
But it's so gorgeous.
It's a beautiful, beautiful building, and it doesn't use it. So it's, again, it's a living building, so it uses only solar energy for all, powering all the pumps and aerators. And inside the building is something called a living machine. And it basically, it's a wetland system where the microorganisms see the poop as food and clean it. And so it doesn't use chemicals to do so. It uses nature. And it cleans the water, and it works, and it supports a whole campus, and it's a really great project.
What I find most delightful about that is that the building itself looks so lovely in a picture, and there's something about the delighting the eye aspect of this that I think catches people's imagination.
Well, beauty is important, and this gets back to the philosophy again, is that if none of this will work if people hate it, if they don't love something, they don't take care of it. They don't honor it and respect it. And they certainly won't gravitate towards the ideas. And so the Living Building Challenge was the first green building system to actually say design and beauty matters. And it has to also be part of the whole sort of philosophy. And I think it's in many ways one of the most important, because it touches on the idea that wherever people are involved, their emotions are involved. And their emotions have to be utilized, if that makes sense.
That also reminds me, just listening to you talk there, I was thinking about yesterday, the symposium was opened by an Indigenous Australian whose name is Uncle Ken Canning. He's a poet and an activist. It was just really powerful to be able to ground what we were doing in First Nations knowledge.
Yeah.
And also he's a fab speaker and just kind of a cool dude. Mm-hmm. But he shared this idea when he was asked, what can we do more broadly about the climate challenge? And he said, one thing we could do is listen more to our elders. And he also said, not just Indigenous elders, although, of course, the context was about their rich, rich, rich wealth of wisdom. But he said, all of our older people, we just don't listen and take the time to listen to those who've gone earlier than us.
Yeah, that
is
true.
Or walk through this earlier than us.
We, as soon as people hit 65, or definitely by 70, they're invisible in society often.
Not Jane Fonda. That because we started off talking
sort of
about
timeless,
that.
Though.
before we started recording, we were talking about Jane Fonda being an activist and getting arrested, which is awesome of her.
Yeah.
But there is a serious point to this. Jason, who were the elders in your life that shaped your wisdom?
Oh, well, I was blessed to have lots of mentors and lots of people that I listened to. I grew up in a family that had a lot of really powerful women. And powerful, I mean, in terms of their love and their support and their ideas.
You're Canadian.
I'm Canadian, and I had both my grandmother, but several of my mother's sisters that were older sisters to her. So I had like several grandmothers, basically. And they really taught me a lot, as did my father. And
did you grow up in a mining community?
I did. I grew up in a mining community called Sudbury, a very polluted place. So
Ontario.
Ontario. Yeah.
And tough place.
A tough place. Yeah, sure. Not as tough now as it used to be. But it was a hard drinking hockey town.
Right. That's why you're sweary.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm just
yet.
Uncivilized, I guess.
Not
so.
Really. So you are given to a bit of effing and blinding. What did your father do?
He was a teacher. Yeah. He He worked at a college in Sudbury, and great guy.
So what did those women who were strong and inspiring around you teach you?
They definitely taught me the love part, and love of nature and love of life and family. And, you know, they encouraged the creative side in me. And then when I went to college and then graduated, I ended up working with another great mentor. His name was Bob Birkebeil. And Bob was
one of the... That's a great name.
Great name, yeah. And
These people sound like storybook heroes. Buckminster Fuller.
Yes. Well, Bob Birkebeil and Buckminster Fuller. And we were just joking about that earlier. But Bob... is this wonderful little Buddha of a man, and great architect, and great mentor. And he was a student of Buckminster Fuller's. And so an interesting sort of lineage there.
What did he teach you?
Well, he taught me how to be an architect. I think he taught me really how to communicate in terms of, I mean, my parents were good communicators, and my father in particular. But Bob taught me how to use it professionally.
But what drew you to buildings?
Well, it's hard to say.
Didn't want to go down the mine?
I didn't want to be a miner. That definitely was not in the cards. I did have miners in my family, though.
But what about architecture? Was there something about building your own house that inspired you, or what was it originally as a kid?
I was doodling buildings from a young age, drawing, you know, castles and buildings from a young age. So there's a story I tell that, you know, I grew up in a mining town that was really polluted. And in the 1970s, there was a giant regreening campaign that started. And eventually won a United Nations.
Like an Earth Day thing.
Eventually won a United Nations commendation because it was one of the most massive tree planting campaigns anywhere. And literally the whole community was terraformed from the 1970s till today.
So you were a kid and you saw this?
So I participated, yeah. I planted tons of trees and everything. And it really basically helped heal my community, and as we all did.
But isn't it interesting, first-hand experience of regeneration?
Yeah. No, that's what got me on the whole system. It's why I'm an environmentalist, is because I grew up in a polluted place that we healed. And that taught me that we can either be agents of destruction or agents of regeneration. And it just matters whether we care enough, whether we love enough. And that's what got it. And then the reason I became an architect is also related to this story, and I think you'll like this part of the story, is a developer came along when I was of a certain age and bought up this hillside that my friends and I had planted trees on and helped to heal.
Oh, no.
And the first thing he did was he cut down all the trees that we planted. And then he...
That feels personal.
Yeah, it was personal. And then he took a bunch of dynamite and blew up the rock that was unique in the world and put in a parking lot and a big box store to sell shit from China to our community. And it was like someone drove a knife in my gut, because I played in those hills and helped heal those hills. And then I saw how quickly development undermined the intention that we provided. And so I realized that design, I didn't have the language to describe it at that age, but intuitively I realized that we had to design our cities differently and our buildings differently to avoid that kind of careless outcome. And it wasn't that this developer was evil, it was just the same everywhere.
But it's the system, back to broken system, it's just how
that's
it was
right.
done,
so,
and still is done.
So my hometown started both my environmentalism and my career by showing me what not to do.
What drove you into leadership? You said to me the other day, people thought you were crazy when you started to write the original document that became the Living Building Challenge, and you left your job and decided to go and follow this crazy dream.
I did.
You also, in your presentation, showed a picture of Greta Thunberg and talked about how leadership can be lonely.
She's my hero.
Me too. I wish she'd won the Nobel Peace Prize. It's lonely when you are a pioneer in whatever field, and I'm sure that many listeners would relate to this in their own fields, when you're trying to do something big or small, but you're an early adopter, it feels lonely because you're not, you know, you're setting the trend or trying to build it, and you have to wait for those to come along.
Well, I think I had the right support from people.
I just, actually, I'm going to answer it for you.
Yeah?
No, you answer it.
No, you answer
it. I just realized what the answer was.
You tell me.
You're a troublemaker.
I am a troublemaker. Absolutely. But I also felt like some people have my back, and that's important. It's easier to stick your neck out if somebody has your back.
Right. But there's something about being willing to just do it.
Yeah, I'm a shit disturber, I guess. I don't know, but when I have a hard time not saying something when something's not right. And I have a hard time also not trying to fix it. Like, if it hasn't been created, well, then fuck, I'm going to take a stab at it. And not that I'm going to get it right necessarily, but it's better to be on the right path than not do anything at all.
Your kids are lucky. How old are they?
Well, they're different ages. They range from 11, which my daughter is my youngest, and we only have three boys in ascending ages.
I ask you that because I'd like to finish up on that, just because I asked you what your elders taught you, what you were like as a kid. I want to bring this back to the house that you built. And I wonder
Aaron
if you
Hall.
Could tell us, just tell us a little bit about the house that you built and then finish by describing your front door.
Well, the house is called Heron Hall, which is named after the herons that live next to the house. We have this beautiful estuary next to us, and there's herons. And I was always a fan of Wind in the Willows with Toad Hall.
Same.
And so I thought that my kids should live in a magical home that's named after, you know, so that's where the name came from. But it's a localist house. By that, like, you think about local food, where you're trying to source all your ingredients from close at hand. So the idea was I tried to get everything from really close. So we milled wood on my site, and we built the walls out of rammed earth, and then we collected tons of salvaged materials from different places.
Amazing windows.
Amazing stuff. Yeah, it wasn't like I took ugly stuff. I went purposefully to find things that had been discarded that were also had character. And sometimes you had to clean them up or repaint them or fix them, but were beautiful. And then I call it salvage modernism, because you then integrate it in a way that it is still modern and fresh, but that it has, you can't really tell how old the building is when you walk into it, because it has this patina and these things that have a range of ages. And so the house is this eclectic modern solar farmhouse, and it runs off the sun. And it has composting toilets.
Of course.
It's off the water grid. It uses only rainwater for all of the water. And if I can say so, it's beautiful. And people come there and go, wow. And that's what I wanted. And to show that you can have a home that's free of redless chemicals, that's tied to the place that it's in, built with care and love and craftsmanship, and yet its environmental footprint is incredibly small, in fact, that the site creates habitat for other species, and it's a lovely place for kids to grow up.
But the door,
yes,
came from a department store. See, we're talking about fashion.
Yes.
And had been used as an installation. Which store? Barney's or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure which one exactly.
Some fancy department store.
We don't need to shame and name them, but it was, from what I understood, it was a hand-carved door in Afghanistan. Beautiful inlays with flowers and all these sort of things, hours somebody spent or people spent. And then it was imported over to the States at some point and used in a retail display. And then it was discarded when the time was over, which is like a shockingly, you know, bad thing to do.
But it's so
very common.
Ordinary. This is what we do in fashion and in,
yes,
retail and in
with sets
marketing and in film and in all
film,
sorts.
Film, exactly. Mm.
So no one wanted what's basically a masterpiece of gorgeous woodwork.
Yes,
with history,
yeah,
and patina and everything you say. But it wasn't the right size to be your door.
Yeah, so I found it in a salvage yard, and it was a very old artifact, and the people were a lot smaller, and so I'm 6'2", and I think it, you know, was 5 feet tall. So it didn't quite work, so I had to build a plinth on that what it would sit on, and then to fill the gap, I created a kick plate out of rusted metal, and it says, all that can save us is a sustained awakening of the human heart.
And that's what your kids see whenever,
yeah,
they come home.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of drill it into their head subconsciously. Every day when they come home from school, they see this sign, and hopefully it gets them to think about loving more deeply.
Jason, you are delightful. I love deeply that we had this podcast and made it happen. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Ah.
Oh, it's getting hard. My parents feel that I'm defending you. I told them all that they are.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. To learn more about our guests and the issues that we've spoken about today, hop on over to my website, which is clairepress.com/podcast. You can get in touch there, and I really hope you will. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also find links to my social media. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe. You know what they say, first in, best dressed. Subscribers are first to find out when there's a new episode, and it also helps other people discover Wardrobe Crisis, so I'd love your help with that, because the more people who switch onto ethical fashion, the better. Music is by Montaigne. She recorded this special acoustic version of Because I Love You, which is from her Glorious Heights album, especially for Wardrobe Crisis. How good is that? Thank you, Montaigne. Because I love you, my parents feel that.
Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.